So we discussed actually a lot about dust during the conference, and we also said that the dust production sources are actually very poorly known, so we don't know where all this dust is coming from. And one suggestion is that a lot of dust is produced in supernova remnants, and that's the topic of my talk. So we'll see how much dust is produced in the galactic supernova remnant, Cassiopeia A. And at the end, I'll also give a brief update on how we can increase the sample of supernova remnants and the constraints in the local universe by doing radiative transfer modeling of optical line profiles. So we all know that in the evolved stellar phases, AGB stars produce a lot of dust. But when we go to high redshift, there is a lot of dust detected in many high redshift galaxies, and it cannot be produced by these AGB stars. So we really need an alternative method to produce all this dust that we observe at high redshift. And then an alternative explanation is, of course, grain regrowth, but we learned here during this conference that it's actually not an option. So we actually need a lot more dust if we can't account for grain growth. We actually need a lot of more dust that is produced in supernovae. So I think that's why these type of studies are very interesting. So just to show you how uncertain the dust production rate is in supernovae, so here you have the initial mass of the progenitor and the dust mass that is produced by each of these stars. So here you see the dust production rates on average by AGB stars, and then here between 8 and about 40 solar masses, you see the dust production rate by supernovae. The first thing that you can notice, so the
pointer,
it's a stick here. Yeah, it might be
easy. And you can hear those who eat too loud.
There's another one here.
So the curves that you see here correspond to theoretical models, each with a different dust condensation efficiency. So you see there's more than two orders of magnitude difference between the models. So it's clear we need to understand better what's going on. Also, the data points that are on here. So here, for instance, for CASE, the one that I will be studying, you see that there's already, from an observational point of view, not only for CASE, but also for the other ones, there's a huge uncertainty there. So it's clear we need to do better. We need to do a better job to constrain how much dust is produced in supernovae. Now, to account for all the dust mass that is observed at high redshift, we would need a single supernova to produce between 0.1 and 1 solar mass of dust. And many models can account for this efficient dust production in supernovae, but it's the observations that clearly lag behind. So before the launch of Herschel and before people started using ALMA, they only detected about 1,000 or up to 100 of a solar mass of new dust that was produced in supernova type 2. So you see here the time since the peak in emission and the dust mass that is produced. So you can see here that clearly it's very low dust masses that have been detected in all of these supernovae. It's only 1987A, more recently, that went up to almost one solar mass of dust that is produced. So then with the advent of Herschel and ALMA, people started to detect a lot more dust in supernova remnants, and three examples are supernova 1987A, where people detected up to 0.8 solar masses of dust using a combination of carbon and silicate type dust. Then in the Crab Nebula, we also find about 0.2 solar mass of dust. Then in CASE, so in CASE you find a clear warm dust component that you can see here that is shock heated in the reverse shock, up to 0.040 solar mass of dust. And then there is some evidence that there's colder dust, 35 Kelvin dust, in the inner regions, which can be up to 0.1 solar mass of dust.
So how are those masses measured?
Different techniques, but most of it is just by SED modeling.
It's optically thin?
They assume that it's optically thin, yeah. That's what it assumes. Now, the remnant that I will be studying and focusing on is CASE. So just to introduce you to the object, so what you see here is the forward shock. And what shines What stands out most is the emission from dust that is shock heated in the reverse shock. And it's this reverse shock also that will be destroying or can destroy a lot of the dust that is produced here in the inner region. So in this part of my talk, I'm going to neglect the reverse shock or how much dust will be destroyed afterwards. I'm interested in how much dust there is right now. So in the literature, people have reported a lot of different dust masses for CASE. Just want to briefly walk you through what has been done in the literature, because I think it's amazing how many different dust masses have been reported. So first observations were done with ISO and IRIS. So you're only sensitive, of course, to the warmer 52 Kelvin dust, and they report 0.04 solar masses of dust by fitting in a CD. Then, based on SCUBA 850 micron observations, so this shows you the total emission map. After subtracting synchrotron emission, they're left with this emission, and Loretta Dunn derived 2 to 4 solar masses of dust in for CASE at a very low temperature. But this result was actually very controversial, as you'll see. Later on, it became clear that most of the emission here that you see in the image when synchrotron emission is subtracted is actually correlated with the gas that you have in the ISM. So you see a clear correlation here between the dust column density that you get from 850 micron and the gas column density that you get from the OH absorption. So this proved that a lot of the dust mass that was found before is actually ISM dust. So it's just the interstellar medium around CASE. So CASE is located in the Perseus arm in our galaxy, so that explains why there's that much interstellar material.
Is interstellar material that's being overrun by the shock, or is it receiving the shock? I mean, how's it reversing to get combusted?
Both in front and behind it.
You mean it's foreground or background?
Or background, yes. It's really just surrounding.
You're saying it's nothing to do with
something. No, it's just ISM.
Is the shape like the supernova or not? The morphology?
Of the ISM?
Of the Dunn image. The image from the Dunn paper.
Okay. Of the dust, well, you can. I can go back. So. This is actually the emission that you see of the dust, well, as observed by...
Yeah, I guess with SCUBA.
Okay.
Look at the next image.
Yes. So this is what they claim. They claim that most of the dust is here.
So that's just the foreground cloud,
isn't it? Yeah. You'll see later on.
It's online, because it's online. What is the probability that it's exactly online?
How do you mean aligned?
The
point is that it is contaminated. It's not only coming from the sun. But
I mean, it's a factor of 100.
It's a large factor. Can I ask? Do I understand that there are molecular clouds that are simply by chance all around the that we see in other supernovae? That's the one.
Yeah, it's in a spiral arm of our Milky Way, so it's really contaminated by.
Also, because the gas is pushed, and so we have. Molecular clouds are really, because
there is some interaction, but the size of this is maybe 5 parsecs, so the size of the entire spiral arm, there's a lot of ISM material just around it that is not affected by
the emission correlates with the lower end, right?
You'll see later on that it's not. So this is just to give you an introduction of. Because later on, already by looking at the Herschel data, going to longer wavelengths, you'll clearly see how the morphology of the remnant is actually changing, or of the emission that we see. So then another study by Loretta Dunn, where they had GCMT 850 micron polarization data, only from this part, is that they found an excess in the level of polarization that could not be explained by synchrotron, and they attributed to one solar mass of dust. So I think they find this excess here, so they assume that most of the dust is now not here, but here, that there's one solar mass of dust here. Then with the Spitzer data, people could nicely observe the shock-heated dust in the reverse shock, and they also find some evidence for colder dust, so up to 0.1 solar mass of dust in the inner regions. But of course, with Spitzer, we only go out to 160 micron. What people could also study with the Spitzer IRS spectra is they could have a spatially resolved spectrum in every region, and you could clearly see that the shape of this of these spectra is very different depending on which location you are in the remnant. And based on the peak that they see here at 21 micron is actually due to silicate type grains. So from these studies, they argue that most of the dust that is produced is silicate type dust. Then Mike Barlow did a study in 2010 as well. So here you see the FACS images, and on the bottom row shows you the spire images. So 70, 100, 160, 250, 350, and 500 micron. So here in the 70 and 100 micron images, you clearly see the shock heated gas. But then when you move on to the spire wave bands, you hardly can recognize the remnant anymore. So this is clearly just all foreground material. And that's why it's so hard to constrain the dust mass that is produced in Cassay.
The scale on this is suddenly blown up, right? I mean, Cassay's in the middle. It's a small object in the middle of that.
It's here now, yeah. Right, yeah, it's just the entire field to show you the structure. So yeah, Cassay here is just somewhere there. It's just really, especially at 500 micron as well, you have a combination of synchrotron and of ISM dust emission. So that's why it's...
Excuse me, what is the relation, the galactic
relation of that? Does that
come from the galactic
relation? I have no idea. I don't think so, if it's in spiral arm, but no.
Do you have CO maps then of these spirals?
Yes, there are CO maps as well. Yeah. And, well, I think they don't mention it here, but they have a similar map here. They look at OH absorption, but they also have similar CO maps that also nicely correlate with the dusts that you see in that inspire 500 micron. Yeah, so maybe to go here, you clearly see this is probably the dust that they detected with SCUBA 850 micron.
Well, actually, you can still see there's a cascade ring, right? I mean, it all is.
You can still see it a little bit. Yeah. But what we have now tried to do is disentangle all of these components on a spatially resolved scale, because that's the only way that we will be able to derive how much dust that is produced. So we have to separate synchrotron radiation, ISM dust emission, line emission, and we want to know how much emission from supernova dust there is. So to do this, we really need to go out to longer wavelengths, because the coldest dust will emit at these longer wavelengths. So general consensus of all these studies, so there is clearly warm dust in the shocked ejecta that dominates the emission that we see in the Spitzer wave bands. There is evidence for some colder dust in the unshocked region, so interior to the reverse shock, but the composition is very poorly known, because unlike in the Spitzer spectra, where you nicely see the features, you can constrain the dust species that are formed there, you cannot do this in the inner region. So depending which dust species you'll fit, the dust masses that you'll derive will be hugely different. And then there's this curious excess emission at 850 micron. Is there cold supernova dust emission? Is there dust polarization? So that's why what we try to study now. So we use almost all the available data that are there. We use the Herschel, PAX, and Spire images. We use Planck photometry to constrain the synchrotron spectrum. We also use the PAX IFU. So on top of Cassay, we have 9 regions that were observed with PAX IFU. Then we have 3 pointings with the Spire FTS spectrometer on Herschel as well. We use IREC 3.68 micron, MIPS, and WISE data. So what I want to show you now is how we model each of those different components to, in the end, derive what the supernova dust emission is. So to model the synchrotron radiation, we collected the most recent Planck data, which you can see here. We also, in addition, use the IREC 3.6 micron image. For instance, the green line that you can see here were fits from other people, so they fit a flattened synchrotron spectrum. And just only to the Planck data, but as you can see, if you extrapolate this, this seriously overestimates the IREC 3.6 micron emission. So this is not a reliable model. So what we use instead is the black line that we fitted to the Planck and IREC 3.6 micron, and we also take into account the uncertainty, which will be important, because going to the Spire 500 micron waveband, there's a significant contribution from synchrotron emission, so we really need to take into account these uncertainties. And this in the end, so we use a 3.7 millimeter image to which we apply this synchrotron model, and we extrapolate it to infrared and submillimeter data, and this is in the end the spatially resolved synchrotron model that we have at 500 micron. Then we also have quite some line.
How much of an extrapolation is that? I mean, you're going down by the spectral fiber. I mean, you're
in the
frequency.
Well, we do it. I guess it's somewhere around here. So this is the 500 micron data point, but we do it up to 24 micron as well. So we really subtract it from all of the images that we will be using for our SED fitting.
So you don't expect the power of the spectral index to change? You can say inside and outside the gamma?
There have been studies, and there have been studies that there are variations mostly outside of the remnant, but within the remnant it should stay more or less constant. But this should also be taken into account in these uncertainty measurements. So we've been really, really very conservative in this. So then we have a lot of line contamination as well. So we use the Spitzer IRS spectrum to constrain the line contribution to MIPS 24 and IRIC 8 micron. We also use the PAX IFU data because we seem to have a lot of O3 line emission from ionized gas in the remnant that is contributing to the PAX 100 micron image. And we also use the Spire FTS, but we don't really find a significant contribution from CO transitions and or C1 lines. But as I told you, we do find contribution from the O3 line. So we have spectra in all of these locations, and the O3 line emission is clearly detected in the remnant and contributes up to 5% at PAX 100 microns. So this is really significant, and we need to correct for that. But since we don't have the full coverage in O3, so we only have spectra in these regions, what we do is we derive the silicon-2 map from the Spitzer IRS spectra and use that instead. So both trace ionized gas. Silicon-2 can also trace neutral gas, but since we hardly detect any neutral gas traces, we assume that it's mostly coming from the ionized gas, and they have more or less similar critical density. So it should be more or less okay. And it's also only 5% at PAX 100 microns, so it's not going to be making a huge difference. Then the ISM confusion is really important. This turned out to be the most important and most tricky component to model. So what we do is we use the Spire 500 micron image as an ISM dust density tracer. And we do allow for a small contribution of supernova dust emission at 500 micron. And what we've done to see whether this is a good assumption, we've actually modeled all of the regions around CASS was observed with Herschel to see whether we indeed get a nice correlation between the ISM dust mass and the 500 micron flux. And this indeed seemed to be true. So this is the Spire 500 micron flux or image after we subtracted the synchrotron component, and we're left with this that we will be using as a spatially.
This is mass in what volume?
I'm sorry?
Mass in what volume?
Mass in? This is the ISM dust mass in solar?
In what volume? I understand the mass inside the supernova remnant, but ISM goes all the way.
No. So this, well, I can show you here. What we actually did is so you have the entire field observed by Herschel. Here is the position of CASS A, but we have all the ISM around it. So what we did is we fitted an SED model to each of those pixels. And then for those pixels, we looked at what is the correlation between the dust mass that we get from this SED fitting and the 500 micron flux in each pixel. So every data point that you see here is a single pixel. So it was just as a test to see, well, can we use the Spire 500 micron flux as a proxy to estimate the ISM dust mass? So, because if you go to longer wavelengths, you're more sensitive to the dust mass than to the temperature. So what we did then is we need to have an SED template. So we need to extrapolate again this 500 micron flux to shorter wavelengths. And for this, we use the Jones et al. Dust model that consists of hydrocarbons and amorphous silicates. And that was calibrated on Milky Way data. So you can see a fit here to one of these ISM regions, and it seems to fit very well. Now, we have this dust composition that seems to work for the Milky Way. The main problem is we need to know to what temperature the dust grains are heated. And this turns out to be the really crucial part. So we define the radiation field as the Hebbing field that is normalized to this value. So this is equals Hebbing field, so 1 G0, which more or less corresponds to a dust temperature of 18 Kelvin. And this is shown here, so you see the template here, the red dashed line. Now, only going to 0.6 G0 or 0.3 G0, which corresponds to temperatures of 16.4 and about 15 Kelvin, so only 3 Kelvin of difference, gives you an entirely different spectrum, as you can see. So all of these were scaled to the same 500 micron flux, as you can see, but when you look at 100 and 160 micron, there is more than a factor of 2 difference in the emission that you would estimate to come from the ISM. So it's clear that we really have to know what the dust temperature is for the ISM dust along the line of sight.
But most of your contamination is from molecular dust and molecular clouds or dense conditions?
It's mostly dense, I think, because the AVs that we derive in the end from our ISM dust mass maps are huge.
So there's variations in the dust models as you go to denser clouds.
That as well. But we carefully checked, so all the modeling that we did around Cassay, we really looked for residuals between the model and the observations here around it, and we didn't find any significant variations there. So it seems that the model is adequate to fit the dust emission, the ISM dust emission.
Did you put any dice models on the dust model?
No, we didn't. No. It's also, you probably along the line of sight, you really have a mixture of diffuse and more dense dust and dust in denser regions.
I think the emissivities change at some model, yeah.
But it is rather intermediate longer than 500. I don't think that there is a bigger change at 500 micron. But I don't know that.
Well, certainly 70 microns, you can get features.
I said, yes, you have all the resonance of that, but that is really at the lower volume. But what is, I don't understand what of it, is you make the same spectrum and you just adjust, you move up and down.
No.
Practically, you assume that it's simply what it changes is only the mass and not the temperature.
No, no, the temperature is definitely changing. So what we have, the dust model, so this shows you just an example. It's really a composition of dust. So we have a grain size distribution, we have different types of grains, and
then
we have a certain radiation field. We just take the Matisse radiation field and we scale that, and we apply that to all of the dust grains that we have, the entire dust composition, and then we calculate non-LTE dust emission for this collection of grains, and this gives us these
templates. The is just the particle is the particle and distribution to the error.
Size, yeah.
So you know the value of G0 you need to fit the data?
We don't know it, so we want to know it, because we see that it gives us completely different.
You are fitting the models to the data in the surrounding regions, that tells you G0.
So that's what there are two ways that we've derived G0. This is the first thing that we did. So we applied the modeling to all of the regions around Cassay, and this gives you the resulting G0 map going from 0.2 to 2.4. But remember, here I just shows you going from 0.3, which is about 15 Kelvin, to 1, which is about 18 Kelvin, gives you this huge difference. So
could you not actually worry so much? Because extinction, local extinction. But what are the sources? I mean, the sources are not local.
No, the sources are from your surroundings.
It's
so once it's extinction, they need large
population.
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely along the line of sight, we cannot make any constraints. So we just assume that the value that we derive here also applies around Cassay. And of course, that's, yeah.
But then each of the pixels, so you have large variations from pixel to pixel, right? But your pixels are normally long. Right? How long are they?
How long are they? How do you mean the each pixel well, here?
To get the mass, you need the length, right? The pixel is just the area. So to get the mass, you need the volume.
Well, it's each pixel is 14 by 14 arc seconds here.
It doesn't come here. But I mean, it's long, right? It's a volume that.
Yeah. You have the column density, yeah.
So then if you have large variations from point to point, presumably also have large variations along the column density, along the regular direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and so you are assuming one value.
Yes.
So
well, we assume one value for, well, we explore different values for G naught, but so what we get from this study is that we see that there's huge variations on very small scales in G naught, so we assume that this is also going to be the case if we look along the line of sight to Cassé. So this will bias the study, of course. What we do see is that we get variations around in the immediate surroundings that maybe go from 0.3 to 1 G naught. But still, we don't have any constraints yet on G naught along the line of sight to Cassé. So that's why we applied a second technique. And what we did here is we looked at the C1 and the two transitions and the CO43 lines that are detected in the ISM along the line of sight to Cassé with the Herschel Spire FTS spectrometer. And we applied PDR modeling to these three line intensities to get a gas density and, again, the radiation fields that can reproduce these line intensities. And so Cassé is more or less located here because this pointing is really north of Cassé. So what we see here is that, so each of these circles show you the results that we get from the spectrum that is obtained in this bolometer of the Spire FTS spectrometer. So what we see here is that most of the regions correspond to a G naught of 0.6. So,
can you just give us an idea of what is the extent of this region that you are sampling?
So these, each of the bolometers are about 40 arc seconds, for a maximum of 40 arc seconds here. Mm-hmm. And the entire region, so Cassé is about 5 parsec across. So it's really, it's a very small region. So you can see already that G naught or the dust, ISM dust temperature clearly changes a lot when you go from one region to another on local scales. So these are the three models. So we have a model for synchrotron emission, we have a model for ISM dust, and we subtracted all of the line emission on a spatially resolved scale. So we have now all of these, we have all of our maps, of which we subtract line and synchrotron emission, and we now fit a multi-component SED model, which consists of our ISM model, assuming a certain radiation field. So what we do, we explored three different SED modeling techniques, each using a different ISM model just to show what the variation is in dust masses that we get for supernova dust. And when we have a three-component supernova model, so a hot, warm, and cold component, we also use different dust species. So this shows you the dust mass absorption coefficient as a function of wavelength. So it basically tells you how emissive your dust will be. If it's going to be more emissive, you need less dust to reproduce the emission. And as you can see here at 160 micron, there's a huge variation depending on which dust species we use. So we'll see that for some of these dust species with a very low emissivity, we'll get huge dust masses, which completely rule out that most of the dust is indeed composed of these grains. So first, I'll show you the results of our global fitting. So this is for an ISM model with G naught of 0.3, G naught of 0.6, and G naught of 1. And each of these curves show you the different components in our model. So the red curves shows you the ISM model. Then you have the hot components, the warm supernova dust components, and the cold supernova dust components. And the one thing that immediately is obvious is that, of course, if you have the G naught equal to 1, the ISM emission really dominates at all wavelengths. So there's little room left for supernova dust emission, while if you have this model, there is a lot more room left for supernova dust emission. So this shows us that we're really very sensitive to the ISM dust temperature to do our analysis. So for these models, we also did a model safety check to just look at the residual to see whether our model is fitting well. There's only the SCUBA 850 micron that we also added. We didn't fit it, but just to check whether our model works. And it is consistent within the error bars, but just because the error bars are huge, also based on the Planck data at 850 micron day, it's so hard to constrain the emission because you have basically emission all throughout, and then you have a certain beam size, so you have aperture corrections that you have to do. So it's really, really hard to constrain what the dust, what the flux level is at 850 micron. That's why we have this huge error bar.
If you just use a standardized dust model to fit across the whole map,
that's what we.
If Class A has some strange component, presumably the ISM model would fit purely just that on its own, do you see that?
Well, that's what we're doing now, but then...
If you don't have any extra components, so just if you do the pure ISM, you don't cast A, how good is it fit?
We haven't done that, but what we first did, and that's similar, we looked at infrared colors. That was our first idea to get GNOT, because the radiation field, the strength of your radiation field should be related to infrared colors. And then we see when we made these infrared color maps, such as 160 over 250, then you really saw an excess or different behavior in CASE. So there's clearly something there, it's just how to get it out.
Could it be explained by variation? That variation just be explained by change in GNOT? Is there some feature in
Feature, no. The only features that you see is at 21 micron, but when you go to longer wavelengths, so if you just look at all of, so all the features are here around 10 and 20 micron, here, okay, here you have a feature as well, but all of the other than the dust emissivity is really flat, so it's really hard at longer wavelength. That's why the colder your dust is, it's hard to find a constraint what the dust is made of, so that makes it really tricky. So then the results that we get, so for the different ISM models with the different ISM temperatures, and also for several dust species. So the first thing that you can tell, so the best fitting supernova dust masses are always higher for this model, because in this model we minimize the ISM dust emission. And here we get the smallest dust masses because we maximize the ISM dust emission.
So sorry, what magnesium 0.7?
This is a silicate type grain, and as you can see, that's actually.
0.7 minimum.
That's if the relative abundance in the grain of magnesium as compared to silicon and oxygen. So I could show you an entire table, but just I want to show you the two silicate type grains that we think are most reliable than a typical specific silicate type grain that is responsible for the feature that we see in a 21 micron. So this dust species or this dust grain is actually found in the shocked region, so in the reverse shock. But if we fit it at longer wavelengths, these are the typical dust supernova dust masses that we get. And it's, of course, if you start from a 30 solar mass progenitor, it's impossible to go to more than 200 solar masses of supernova dust. So we clearly rule out this dust species. Then amorphous carbon is also less likely, because if we look at the gas in the gas phase, there is a lot of oxygen found in CASE. So we focus here mostly on this ISM model, just because we think it gives us the best constraint for the radiation field that is heating the ISM dust. And the dust mass that we derive for silicate type grain is between 3.5 and 2.2 solar masses of dust. Of course, there are some uncertainties, of course, because the first uncertainty is from observational constraints, but also if we just compare these three ISM models, there is some variation here as well. We also derived a minimum dust mass, supernova dust mass, which we derive by minimizing or the supernova contribution at 500 microns, so leaving no room for a contribution. So as I told you, what we did as well, based on nucleosynthesis models, we can predict the amount of heavy elements that is produced in CASE, and we can estimate for each of these dust species how much dust can be present if we believe the nucleosynthesis models. So this is actually up to 1.4 solar masses of dust if we assume that all of the metals that have been produced in CASE in the end end up in these grains as well. So we're actually really limited. But I need to say as well that there are some uncertainty factors on these nucleosynthesis models, definitely factor of two. So take this with some caution, of course. I have taken the upper limit, 30 solar masses. So there are models that indicate between 23 and 30 solar masses. So really took the upper limit to also give you here the upper limit of dust mass that is possible. Okay.
I mean, in the Wuxian River grid, they have, you know, constant energy. So if you increase the progenitor mass, the real fallback is larger and you have less energy.
Okay.
You even have that lower mass progenitors produce a larger amount.
Okay. I can check that. Yeah, that's a good idea. But in any case, it will be one or two solar masses, I would say, at most that we can expect. That we did a spatially resolved fit as well. So in every pixel, we did the SED modeling now, and these are the results that we get from this. So we get a cold supernova dust mass map, a warm supernova dust mass map, and a hot supernova dust mass map. And by combining all of these different supernova dust components, we get this total dust mass map of dust that we think is produced in Cassay. I've also indicated in red the forward shock, and in white, you can see the reverse shock. So interesting from this is that we seem to be finding most of the dust within the reverse shock, and that's what we would expect, right? This is where conditions are perfect, temperature and density is perfect for dust condensation to take place. What we also expect is that once the reverse shock passes, so it's moving inwards, is that most of the dust will actually be destroyed. So it seems that the results that we get from our SED modeling is consistent with this model. There are some hints as well of here some dust around it. So, and that's actually, that seems to be located where we also find the jets. So maybe this is dust that is ejected. Well, that's, I mean, it's a very maybe if you see the uncertainties on the model, but.
My country, the numbers here, 10 to the minus 3, and the previous one was 0.5.
But you have to add all of this, eh? So I'll show you now, I think. No.
It's mass per pixel.
Yeah. Sorry. This is per pixel. So in the end, I have a table as well that will show you the results from our resolved SED modeling. So as a check, what we did, we compared observations with the models that we have based on these SED models. So if we take 14 arcsecond pixels, then we actually have 440 resolution elements that go into this. So we do 440 times SED modeling, and this shows you the MIPS-24, the PUX wavebands, and this shows you SPIRE wavebands. And this shows you as well the residual. So as you can see, in every pixel, it seems that the model very well corresponds to the observations here. In the area where we have very little dust emission of the ISM, there are some discrepancies, but overall seems to be working pretty well. We also made this chart that we get out of our models to show you the contribution of each of these components at every wavelength. I think it's really interesting. So only looking at SPIRE 500 micron, we have 40% coming from synchrotron emission, almost 60% of ISM dust, and then we have a couple of percent. So this is within the error bars, of course. That's why sometimes we have lower percentages that don't add up to 100 or sometimes higher. So there's maybe 4% of supernova dust emission at SPIRE 500 micron, 10% at SPIRE 350 micron, and of course it dominates at 70 and 100. But I think this shows you how difficult it is from an observational point of view to constrain how much dust is produced. So what we did as well, we used all of these total emission maps. This shows you the maps after we subtract line and synchrotron emission. And this shows you the map that we get after subtracting the ISM model. So the emission that you see here corresponds to the emission that we expect to come from supernova dust emission. So the residual after removing all of the other contaminating emission. And this is for the three different ISM models that we've been using. So what you can see here at MIPS 24 micron, you still have most of the supernova dust emission, of course, coming from the reverse shock. But then when we go to longer wavelengths here at SPIRE 100 micron, you see these three emission features still in the reverse shock, but you start to identify emission coming from the central regions as well. You can see it here as well. And most of the ISM models also give a very consistent result. So you start to see here where we also, in the total dust mass map, see a peak. So most of the supernova dust emission seems to be coming from the central region here. We also compared our models to the SCUBA 850 micron image. So this is the one published by Loretta Dunn, the total emission. This is our model for synchrotron radiation, our ISM model, and this is the supernova dust model that we have. Adding all of these up, we get this, and that compares very well to Loretta Dunn's models. Of course, SCUBA 850 micron has a better resolution. Here we convolved everything to Spire 500, which is 36 arc seconds, and this has about 15 arc seconds resolution, I think. So you see some more features here that we are not able to reproduce, of course, at that resolution. It's interesting to also compare the scales. So this is 1/10 of a Jansky, 1/100 of a Jansky, 1/1000 of a Jansky. So we're clearly dominated by a synchrotron emission. Then the overview of results that we get. So again, it's the same as before. We have the supernova dust mass, the temperature that we get for the three different ISM models, and the maximum that we could expect from nucleosynthesis models. So we focus here.
Is it not monotonic, the third line? Wait, 0.1, 0.4, 0.1.
But just sometimes, it depends sometimes on the temperature as well. So mostly on what we saw on global scales is that, yeah, of course, you minimize the ISM contribution here. But if you do it on a resolved scale, sometimes you get that your template is just skewed to lower temperatures. So that's why it's not always completely consistent. But for the two silica type grains, so we completely can rule out this because it's impossible to have that much dust produced in Cassé. So we think that we have about 0.4 to 0.7 stolar masses of dust. This gives us our best estimates, both with an uncertainty of about 10 to 20% easily. We could also fit the SCDs on resolved scales with 0.5 stolar mass of amorphous carbon. But as I said, it's less likely because we see that much oxygen in this remnant that we think most of the dust should be silicate type grains. So comparing global and spatially resolved SCD fitting, we seem to be finding larger dust masses from a global fit. And we actually think that the spatially resolved SCD fitting gives us a better idea, simply because in every individual pixel, the spectrum looks so differently that it's impossible to get a very well-constrained dust mass from our global SCD fitting, simply because you add up all these different spectra that look so different that it's very difficult to constrain dust mass. So we mostly believe these results, of course, with some uncertainty. We also made an interstellar extinction map. And this is mostly interesting because a lot of people have argued that in Cassé, so Cassé is very hydrogen poor, and in the evolved stellar phase, it seems that most of the hydrogen was expelled or was removed from the star. And people think that this is, can be attributed to a binary. And so people have looked in the optical for binaries, whether something could be detected. And this gives you the interstellar visual extinction that we get from ISM dust and from supernova dust. So it's clearly dominated by ISM dust, and going up to values of around 10 explains why we haven't detected any remaining binary star yet. So the main results that we get from this is that we can rule out several dust species, simply because to reproduce the SCD, we need way too much dust of these species, which is impossible in Cassé. So we think that silicate type grains, mainly these two type of grains, are dominant in Cassé. We find a cold supernova dust mostly distributed within the reverse shock region, what we would expect as well, because it seems once we go beyond the reverse shock that there's less dust there, so this could indicate dust destruction there. There's a possible hint for dust ejection along the jets, but we're not completely sure. And our best fit model predicts between 0.4 up to 0.7 solar mass of silicate type dust at a temperature of 30 Kelvin. So this would be sufficient to explain the dust in the early universe if, of course, it's not destroyed in the end by the reverse shock, because we've seen that it seems that part of the dust is indeed destroyed by the reverse shock. We've done a quick comparison from the dust mass that we get within the reverse shock and the dust mass that we get outside it, and then it could be that more than 70% of the dust is produced, is destroyed when we compare those two. So dust destruction indeed seems to be significant.
Your maps of SiO around that?
Not sure. You mean of
the gas phase results in dust destruction?
Haven't looked into that. I've only focused on that would be interesting. Yeah, that would be very interesting. I think that's definitely the way forward, because now there are only models about dust destruction in supernova remnants, and to really see how efficient it is, I think that would be very interesting. Yeah. Well, there's so many more things to do. This is one case. We need to
estimate the amount of destruction. What you assume, you just compare the total mass that you have inside. You're assuming that
we're
trying to understand how you came up with the 70% destruction.
Well, that's a very crude estimate, and what we end up, what we will do what you should do is actually assume a spherical distribution of the dust, and then just what we did now is compare the average dust mass surface density that you get here to the average dust mass surface density that you get there. And that's what gave me the 75% with some error bars.
But don't you have to rescale it with the gas density? If you assume that for a certain gas density, you produce a proportional amount of dust, right? You have to look at how much gas do you have, gas mass do you have outside the reverse shock and inside, and then rescale the dust masses to that to get the destruction.
Yes. So that's what I'm trying to do now. Basically, just assume what you could do as well is just assume a spherical distribution, that a sphere is completely filled with dust. If you look in the middle of the, or you draw a line through the middle, the center of the sphere, then you'll have way more dust along the line of sight than when you go to an outer region. So that might be part of the explanation as well, why you get less dust. And that's something that I'm trying to do now.
If you just do the spherical average profiles, do you see any break in the shock?
I haven't done it yet. I haven't. That would be a good idea. That would be nice to make.
Can I show your AD? Sorry.
Oh, good.
Can I show your AD plot again?
Yep. Yes.
So you have AV is of the order of several magnitudes.
Yes.
So is it sensible to have G naught of the order of 1 and AV so high? Wait a minute. If you're interested in G zeros, because you're shooting from the outside, and outside is G zero of the order of 1, right? So how can you have G zero of 1 if you have such a high AV?
Deeper within the cloud, of course, it will be a lot lower, but we assume that around Cassay, the densities are not that high. It's more along the line of sight, and there, of course, G-naught will be a lot lower. That's true.
You might wonder if you wouldn't be better with the high galactic latitude supernova remnant like 10.06, right? I mean, and it might also have other advantages, like the reverse shock actually having done a fair amount of crossing, right? I mean, therefore you actually know what dust you're going to get finally.
Yeah.
No.
I have a similar point that if you look at type 1A supernova remnants, right, which are away from the galactic plane, don't have all this mess around it, but I just searched for the sort, and I don't know, they don't have any dust.
40 degrees galactic latitude or something, it's high, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's actually well under the galactic.
Yes, and then they're in a nice environment, they're spherical, but these, finally, people find all dust.
But it's 1A or what type of dust that
that's true, that's quite interesting.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
So it tells you
the right answer. Right.
Yeah, but they're short, and it doesn't produce the universal and shocks, and type 1A's don't.
1A's can't make dust, is
no. It? No. No, so we only look at type 2s.
It's a density issue.
Why can't I?
I think that only Takaya Mizawa has done a paper on that, but I don't remember if the main limitation was the explosion properties or if it was the.
I think explosion properties is exactly the same. So one difference is that, let's say, 1006 is there they see the shock, they see proper motion of the shock. So with Chandra, so you know exactly parameters. It's you know the H, you know the shock expansion. So you know everything about the supernova remnant, but the ambient density from the shock properties is like randomized too. So it's very tenuous gas, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it means that in the shock, the density is also not very high, and that's probably why it's not making dust, because the density.
Well, actually, there is power. Our mission in 1006 has been detected.
But apparently, the interpretation is not dust.
So I just
looked at the paper and says, just like any other supernova type 1A remnant, 1006 has no dust, has no evidence of dust.
But I think that dust is not producing shocks. Dust is producing in the ejecta as it expands. So as it expands and the temperature decreases, then you have the right conditions to have, presumably, to condense the first part. So I think that the fact that you have a more continuous gas doesn't matter really. I think it has more to do with the dynamics of the expansion.
But the type 1As are coupled with this iron, coupled with
exactly.
This oxygen,
and
right?
And I was about to say also the composition, the gas composition. So I think that we should go back and look at this Takaya's paper where he made the calculation. He actually applied the same formalism that he and others like us used to compute gas formation in type 2. And we got that, an argument of why the production is so less efficient.
The huge difference is that type 1A is produced either carbon or silicon, right? So just iron with
exactly. You can form some iron grains in principle, but I'm not sure that's, I can't really answer. Just have to go back and look at the calculation. But the general, in the community, the general idea
carbon,
is
right?
That type 1A are not dust
productors.
No,
but it's burned, like in the
explosion. Not all the way.
No, everything is converted. Like there's, I think, two elements. Like half of the mass is iron in the end,
mm-hmm.
half is what I'm gonna do.
But
there's
iron
is
the dominant. Iron.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
But there's no oxygen in the carbon.
Maybe if you have five more minutes, I just want to show you how we want to increase the sample. So of course we want to look at other galactic supernova remnants, but they're not that many. And as you can see, it's really tricky. As soon as there's a lot of ISM dust along the line of sight, it's really, really tricky. So to increase the sample size, what we want to do is we want to move away from the infrared where the resolution is poor and where we can only resolve supernova remnants in our own Milky Way. ALMA can maybe resolve other supernova remnants at larger distances, but it won't be sensitive enough. So it's only sensitive up to maybe to detect supernova 1987A, and that's one that just went off. So. Well, ALMA is not the way to go as well. So how do we go beyond the local group? Well, an alternative way of deriving the supernova dust mass is to look at the effect of dust on optical line profiles. So for supernova 1988S, you see here the line profile after 80 days, and that completely changes after 450 days when dust formation has taken place. So the idea is that you have an expanding shell of ejecta, you have dust formation, and when you look at it from this side, the side that is approaching will not be obscured, so the blue wing just remains the same, but you have serious dust obscuration, so scattering absorption on the receding side, and that's why you had this red wing asymmetry here. So I think this might be the way forward now to better constrain dust mass in supernova remnants also beyond our own Milky Way. So a student at UCL, Antonia Bevan, has written a thesis on this, and she applied a code, radiative transfer code, that she wrote to supernova 1987A at different epochs, so after 2.2 years, 5 and about 8 and 10 years. So she looked at H-alpha and O1 line profiles and fitted this with her model. Spherical symmetric model, she could really constrain as well the dust formation. So if you look at the dust mass that she finds as a function of the days since explosion, you can clearly see that there is an increase in the dust mass, which is also consistent with what Roger Wesson had derived. She also started applying this to gas A. So rather than looking at the individual spectra that you have, what she did is she derived an integrated spectrum where you can also clearly see the line asymmetries. And applying her model, you find up to 0.9 and 1.1 solar mass of dust. Of course, this comes with uncertainties because you have to make assumptions about the dust species. You have a spherical symmetric model, which might not be that applicable to CASE because you clearly see some asymmetries already. But I think this might be the way forward. So in blue, you see the observed line profile. You see the clear asymmetry here. And in red, you see the model that is fit to this. So the dust masses that we derive from this are consistent, I would say, with the dust masses that we get as well. Of course, there are some uncertainties, but at least within one order of magnitude, we can more or less say what the dust mass is that is produced. Also for supernova 1987A, and she also applied this already to two extragalactic supernova remnants. And currently, during this semester, we have 50 hours of VLT time, so we'll get X-shooter spectra going from UV to near-infrared for 25 supernovae with ages between 4 and 60 years old, all in extragalactic sources, so up to 30 megaparsecs. So hopefully, we'll get a bigger sample to constrain how much dust is produced in supernovae. Thank you.
For example, right? I mean, that's not a high galactic latitude, which is a type 2, right? Or is that just getting too diffuse and too mixed up with interstellar medium, right?
You mean for this type of study or for?
Yeah, for a dust production study, right?
But for looking at the infrared, or you mean?
I mean, is that just too hard?
I think it's mostly a resolution issue, so you have to do it in our own Milky Way if you use Herschel data, because otherwise if you go more distant, you cannot resolve it anymore, and it's also a sensitivity issue, I think.
You mean when the things get too large, right? I mean, that's
or too faint, but the most important constraint is really a resolution issue, because that was the idea, to look at beautiful maps of nearby galaxies from Kingfish survey, for instance, so we still need to do that, but the problem will be that you maybe see a spot, but it's...
I was more thinking about, when does it stop being possible in our own galaxies?
Okay, as well.
I mean, you have things like Vela, I mean, it's 10,000 year old, it's, extended, right?
Yeah.
It's presumably too large, and the detection is getting too large to separate.
Yes, as well, because, I think
at what point does it become impossible?
I think you want it to be in a free expansion phase so that there's not a lot of interaction between ISM and the ejecta. I think that's probably that you still can clearly separate what is supernova dust and what is ISM dust.
Yeah, you just swept up too much ISM and you can't separate out the supernova dust anymore.
Unless you have the resolution, you get into the center if you want to have an idea of how much dust is survived.
You can get the resolution on Vela, it's a pretty extended object, right? I mean, so you could look at it.
So what if you go to very low metrics of the galaxy, the supernova runs there, might be easier to pick out.
That's true. That's true, yeah. I think in the sample that we have, we tried to make sure we had representative samples as well as explosion or date since explosion, but also metallicity. So I think we have some low metallicity objects and some supernova remnants there. So it might be interesting to have a look, yeah. But, or do you mean on dust emission side as well? But that's why, supernova 1987A in the Magellanic Clouds. So it might be interesting to look at Magellanic Clouds as well. We're working with people in Australia to get line profiles as well for several remnants in the Magellanic Cloud. So, then we can maybe compare as well. But
isn't the problem with doing this though, that you don't know what the first shock destructive is, and therefore you don't know, you know, I mean,
as well.
I mean, what the true, I mean, cost injection is. I mean, wouldn't you actually be better going with older objects?
That's true. But first, you initially already don't know how much they produce, so you even don't know how much can be destroyed. So it's a two-way process, I would say. And as soon as...
But I mean, Len, I think he's pointing out what we... I mean, it's very interesting, but what we really care is how much of the dust has survived.
So I agree.
This is what we'll enter.
An old remnant in very low density galaxy, sure.
I haven't done the calculations. I should probably do it. I mean, I know it's really, really tricky, so it might be interesting to have a look at that.
I think that would be a very interesting measurement, because in fact, I mean, you wouldn't have the ionic contamination, but you'd have the destruction, and you'd be measuring the true dust injection. That's the number you could do.
It might be interesting to have a look. I'm 1 year in this field, so I'm really new, and if you shout some objects to me, I might not even know them. So, but it might be interesting to have a look. I know there are several in the Magellanic Cloud, so maybe we can integrate for longer and indeed study an older one and just not look at supernova 1987A. That's true.
So, actually, I don't think there are any supernova type 2 remnants that are nice and round, just like they're on the inside. And that's why, by itself, it's very interesting why. I would think that if you have a star cluster that keeps exploding, right, if we believe models, the models say that the previous supernova should clear and bubble, right, and then subsequent ones should explode in a nice environment.
Actually, Cassie is completely counter to that, isn't it? Because I mean, it's a total structure around it, right? I mean, there's tons of stuff in the star, like shells and all the rest of
that. My point is that we, unlike what models predict, that there should be multiple supernovae in a typical star cluster, and later supernovae should explode in a nice environment, but we don't see those type of remnants, which is
very you do see some like purposes, actually.
Spherical remnants?
I mean, what is a spherical remnant? There are very few spherical remnants.
That's my point. But that's not that, I don't think that's too...
But, I mean, even if you blast off and make it so medium, you're not going to clear that spherical structure.
But we see 1006, which is almost spherical.
But here you see it mostly because of the interaction with material that is there. So if it would be completely spherical and keeps on expanding after another remnant has gone off, how do you detect it?
You detect it as a regular supernova remnant, like that, like 1006. It explodes in a diffuse environment that's pretty smooth, and you see it, you see a spherical remnant.
But there are no such environments, since like it's only because of its high galactic quantity.
But my question is why? So why in the supernova that explodes, say, 30 million years after the age of the star cluster, where hundreds of supernova exploded before that, why was the previous supernova didn't
look good? Well, you should try looking at Orion, right? I mean, it's...
You know, Orion is too young
for that, right? No, I mean, it's
you're probably missing a lot of remnants in these low-density regions.
Why?
Because the shell isn't obvious.
Yeah. But why is it obvious in 1006? I mean,
well, it's obvious in very dense regions.
Anyway, I mean, I guess in 1986 so, was known as a historical supernova, right? I mean, it's a new history. Right.
When I talked to Wang, who was studying X-ray remnants, like with X-rays remnants, he said there are no spherical type 2 remnants. They're all kind of in a very, you know, very complicated environment, so both they are getting channels through chimneys and so on.
So the point is, if there is an observation like that, it's
I think you detect
most of it, like in remnants, but I do think there are incredibly messy environments, right? I mean, not places where you can easily clear up on the genial shell, right?
We're often running into these complicated stellar wind environments, you know, late stage massive stellar evolution, a lot of different mass loss in the WB phase.
No, but if you mark Krupel's 2 weeks ago, give a talk, and the model predicts that after a few supernova, the environment becomes very simple.
You need them to look for clusters which are like 10 million years old. So I don't know, someone should just take a look at those.
But I mean, so why don't we see them? Is it just because we're...
Maybe no one just looked. Maybe no one looked at old clusters because like, I'm not interested. I mean, people only look at low, I don't know, at young clusters, which are things are happening. So much.
Yeah.
maybe just an observation of ours.
Yeah, let me go back to Orion. I mean, you actually have shells in the association that go way back, right? There's no homogeneity to that, right? I mean,
it's young, so it shouldn't be homogeneous.
Young in the sense of the elder, I mean, the sort of older stars, I mean, the ones fairly far back in the sequential star formation, actually. There's been four OB associations in Orion, right? And some of them are quite old.
We need a high frequency of explosions as well, no? In sources like Milky Way, it's probably...
Yeah, so I think it marks the two clear homogeneous shells, right? I mean, I think that's... If it's an observational basis for that, I don't think
it's... But it's maybe more and more compact, really starburst galaxies where you get the high frequency of explosions, no? Because
high frequency from any star cluster, you take 10 to the 5 small mass star clusters, which are observed in a Milky Way, they'll explode thousand supernovae in one place in 30 million years. Thousand supernovae going one after the other, keep sweeping the stuff.
Well, they see supershells.
Supershell, but so why the hundreds of thousands of supernovae, why doesn't it explode in a nice environment that is in like nice spherical?
But maybe as a result, they form low density environment, the short people will be very private. Maybe just take very little time.
But that's true for 1006. So 1006 explodes in a tenuous environment, and you see short exploding at one.
So there's one, right? So there's one.
But they all, there are several like this, but they all have one answer. So type 1A is accelerated, so unlike type 2, so they expect it to come.
Well, there are also type 2 protons, so probably not very
good. Are there more questions for
this? Yes, absolutely. The poor Ilse is standing there without lunch, by the way, so that's type 1A.